Respiration physiology.
The process of breathing is called external respiration. Under normal resting conditions, the respiratory rate in an adult is 12 to 14 times per minute. Breathing is involuntary, that is, you are not aware of it until you consciously think about it. Yet you can change your rate of breathing, therefore overriding the involuntary mechanism regulated by the autonomic nervous system and the respiratory centre in the brain. Some people can hold their breath for several minutes.
The reason that you breathe is so the cells in the body receive oxygen gas, required to convert glucose, fats or proteins into ATP in the mitochondria. In this process, carbon dioxide is released as a waste product. This process within the cells is internal respiration. During respiration, oxygen enters the lungs and diffuses into the blood. Carbon dioxide is exhaled from the lungs after diffusing out of the blood into the lungs. In addition, respiration together with the kidneys regulates acid-base balance in the body. Respiration anatomy. The lungs are the respiratory organs, and along with the nasal cavity, pharynx, larynx, trachea, chest and diaphragm are the essential anatomical components of the respiration apparatus. This is a complex system that leads air into the lungs and out again. Learning outcomes.
After completing this module, you should be able to describe the respiration apparatus anatomy, explain what we mean by respiratory membranes, provide a detailed description of the alveolar structure, explain what surfactant is and what role it has in the lungs, explain the pleural membrane organisation and function.
The nasal cavity is divided into two by a dividing wall called the nasal septum. Each of the nostrils lead to each half of the nasal cavity. The air from each half meet and mix completely behind the soft palate. In each half of the nasal cavity, we have three folds, the conchae nasalis. These folds give the nasal cavity a large surface. The air that is breathed in enters the nasal cavity and distributes above and below the three folds. The air is filtered, humidified, and heated. Inside the nasal cavity, we find mucus that moistens and captures dust and other particles. In addition, there are cells with cilia that brush away particles. Cilia located anteriorly in the nasal cavity brush towards the nostrils, while the cilia posterior to the nasal cavity brush particles back so that it ends up in the throat and finally into the stomach, where any bacteria are killed by the acidic gastric juice. The cells that make the mucus also secrete various substances, including lysozymes and defensins, which have antibacterial effects. In addition, the nasal cavity also functions as a resonant chamber and odour organ. The sensory cells for smell are located in the roof of the nasal cavity. From the nasal cavity, the air is led into the throat, pharynx. The pharynx is divided anatomically into three regions: the nasopharynx, the upper part; the oropharynx, the middle part; the laryngopharynx, the lower part. In the nasopharynx are the tonsils and the opening of the Eustachian tube. The wall of the nasopharynx has skeletal muscle, which initiates swallowing, a voluntary mechanism. In the oropharynx, air and food are mixed. Here too we find the tonsils. At the bottom in the laryngopharynx, there is smooth muscle that contracts during the swallowing process in an involuntary contraction, which is initiated in the nasopharynx.
Below the laryngopharynx is the larynx,
containing the vocal cords. The larynx is the air passage that takes air into the trachea,
or windpipe.
In the laryngopharyngeal region, air is led into the trachea, and the food is directed down the esophagus. So when you breathe, you will not normally swallow, and when you swallow, you do not breathe. The epiglottis, laryngeal cartilage cap, has an active role in this process. The epiglottis controls switching between air and food supplies by bending to cover over the trachea during swallowing and thus preventing food entering the trachea. The trachea windpipe.
The trachea is 10 to 12 centimetres long, relatively a movable pipe with a diameter of approximately 2 centimetres.
The trachea has about 18 cartilage rings surrounding it, ensuring that the trachea at any given time is open. The trachea and the esophagus are loosely held together. The cartilage rings are C-shaped and are connected by smooth muscle on the posterior side of the tube. This enables the body to regulate the diameter of the trachea and regulate the volume of air passing through the tube. In the trachea, there are mucus-producing cells with cilia. Cilia remove dust and particles from the trachea by moving towards the epiglottis, so that the mucus with dust and particles enter the stomach during swallowing. Bronchi and bronchioles. The trachea divides into two bronchi, one for each lung. The bronchi branch off into smaller bronchioles. Bronchioles have a diameter of less than 1 millimetre. In bronchioles, there are no cartilaginous rings, but cartilage discs make them more rigid. The bronchiolar epithelium has no cilia and does not produce mucus. There is an increased amount of smooth muscle around the bronchioles. When they contract, these muscle cells narrow the diameter of the bronchioles so that the volume of air entering and leaving the alveoli is regulated. This is covered later. Bronchioles branch off to the terminal bronchioles, which have a diameter of less than 0.5 millimetres. The terminal bronchioles lead to the respiratory bronchioles. The respiratory bronchioles terminate in a cluster of bubble-like structures called alveoli or alveolar sacs. The alveoli. The alveoli, along with the respiratory bronchioles, constitute what we call the respiratory zone. This is where gases are exchanged between the air in the alveoli and the blood in the surrounding capillaries. The barrier between the air and blood is therefore very thin here. The epithelium in the alveoli is a single layer of squamous epithelial cells, called type 1 cells. Thus, the barrier between blood and air is histologically as thin as it can be. In addition to the capillaries, the alveoli are surrounded by elastic fibres. The elastic fibres clamp alveolar sacs together. This gives the lung tissue elastic properties that can stretch when breathing in and recoil back again when breathing out. The latter is a passive process, not requiring energy. The alveoli are organised into clusters of air-filled bladders. Pores between neighbouring alveoli allow air to diffuse from one alveolus to another. The gases in the lung therefore diffuse across the alveoli, so the concentrations of the various gases are relatively similar across all alveoli in the respiratory zone. In the alveoli, in addition to the type 1 cells that form the alveoli wall, other cell types are present. The macrophages belong to the immune system and eat particles, dust, and invading microorganisms that may enter the alveoli. Type 2 cells are cells that secrete surfactant. We will cover this later. Inside the alveoli, there is a thin film of water. The alveoli are not dry. This moisture is essential to maintain the diffusion of gases through the cell membrane, including the alveoli wall. Gases do not diffuse through dry membranes. Surfactant. Surfactant is a kind of soap-like substance that nullifies the surface tension in the alveoli. The surface tension is created by the thin film of water lining the alveoli. You may have observed that some insects walk on water, and if you're careful, you can get a needle to float on the surface of water. It is as if there is a film on the water surface that insects and the needle float on. The explanation of this is that at the water surface, where water meets air, water molecules attract to each other more strongly with the water molecules below them than with the layer of air immediately at the water surface. Remember that water molecules are dipoles, which mean they have opposing charges at each side of their molecular structure, so they can attract each other like magnets. The water molecules pull on each other, creating a surface tension which acts like a film on the water surface. If a drop of soap or detergent is dropped into the water, the needle sinks immediately. The detergents, such as phospholipids, are both fat-soluble and water-soluble. If they are added to water, they align themselves on the surface of the water because the fat-soluble part does not dissolve in water and is repelled away from the water. This layer is therefore left in the air. In this way, the detergent disturbs the water molecules that form the surface tension, so that the needle does not keep afloat. In the alveoli, the film of water inside them creates a surface tension which could collapse the alveoli. To counteract this, the type 2 cells in the alveoli membrane secrete surfactant that reduces the surface tension of the water and thus prevents the alveoli from collapsing. Surfactants in the lung are produced in the fetus right at the end of pregnancy. Lack of surfactant is therefore a real problem in premature babies. Their immature lungs will remain collapsed due to the surface tension in the alveoli. This can be treated with surfactant-like medication. Alveolar blood supply. The alveoli receive blood from two circulation paths. They receive blood from the pulmonary artery. This is blood coming directly from the right ventricle, entering the lungs to pick up oxygen. In addition, there are dedicated arteries branching from the aorta supplying the bronchi. This blood supplies the lung tissue with nutrients and oxygen. The pleural cavity. The lungs are surrounded by two pleural membranes that create the cavity in which the lungs are located. The pleural cavity is a fluid-filled space that surrounds each lung and contains 1 to 2 mL of fluid per lung. Histologically, the pleural cavity is organised in a similar way to the pericardium, the cavity containing the heart. The membrane forming the pleural cavity that is attached to the lung tissue is known as the visceral pleura. The pleural membrane, which is directly attached to the inside of the thorax, is called the parietal pleura. This encloses the inside of the ribs and connective tissue and the diaphragm. Between the visceral and parietal pleura is the pleural space, containing the pleural fluid, only about 1 to 2 mL. Though a small volume of fluid, this is enough to cause the visceral and parietal pleura membrane to stick to one another, but still be able to slide relatively smoothly over each other when the lung expand and contract. This is like a drop of water between two polished glass surfaces. Even if you just hold the top glass sheet, the bottom one will not fall off. Since the parietal pleural membrane is attached physically to the inside of the thorax and the visceral pleural membrane physically to the surface of the lung tissue, it is the forces between these two membranes that keeps the lungs distended so that the lung tissue can expand as thorax expands. The membranes are gliding over one another. This means that when the thorax expands, the lungs follow. This is what happens when we breathe in. During inhalation, the diaphragm and intercostal muscles between the ribs, contract. The diaphragm lowers towards the abdomen and the thorax rises anteriorly. The volume of the lungs increases and thus creates a vacuum, sucking air into the lungs through the nasal and oral cavity. During expiration, the muscle contractions cease. The intercostal muscles and diaphragm relax and return to their original resting shape. This squeezes the lung tissue together due to the elasticity of the lung tissue, which makes the lungs recoil, forcing air out of the lungs. Pneumothorax. If an object enters the thorax, it could puncture the pleural cavity. If there are holes in the pleural cavity, air comes between the parietal and visceral pleural membranes. The two membranes are then wholly or partially separated, causing the lung to collapse. This is called a pneumothorax and will cause difficulties with breathing. This can be rectified by inserting a drain with a vacuum that sucks out the fluid and air from the pleural cavity. Summary. Breathing in air is achieved by contracting the diaphragm and intercostal muscles so that volume in the thorax increases. This creates a negative pressure in the lungs, which draws air in through the nose and mouth. The air in the nose, and to a certain extent the mouth, is heated and humidified before it passes down the pharynx. From the pharynx, the air passes over the larynx and epiglottis, which controls the air passage to the trachea. Down the trachea, a 10 to 12 centimetre long tube, air passes to the right and left bronchus. Through the bronchi, which branch off and become narrower and narrower, the air passes to the bronchioles and finally to the alveoli. The alveoli are surrounded by tiny capillaries, and between the air in the alveoli and the blood in the capillaries, there is only a thin barrier so that oxygen and carbon dioxide gas can easily diffuse across. In addition to the capillaries, the alveoli are also surrounded by elastic fibres, which together with the alveoli surface tension is pushing alveoli together. The pleural cavity, a small cavity between the lungs and the thorax wall, is counteracting these forces and pulls the lungs up against the thorax by the attraction between the visceral and parietal pleural membranes. The visceral and parietal membranes are attached to the lung tissue and inside of the thorax wall respectively. When the volume of the lungs expands during inspiration, the parietal membrane is pulled as well as therefore expanding the lung volume. Respiration physiology. Breathing consists of two processes, breathing in, inspiration, breathing out, expiration, exhalation. As mentioned earlier, due to the negative pressure in the lungs during inspiration, air is pulled into the lungs. During expiration, positive pressure is restored, which pushes the air out again when the elastic lungs recoil. Learning outcomes. After studying the topic of respiratory physiology, you should be able to explain what air pressure and partial pressure are, account for various respiratory volumes, explain what is meant by dead space and the implications of it, specify ways for oxygen and carbon dioxide gases to be transported via the blood, explain the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve and how it changes with increased temperature and carbon dioxide amount in the blood and the physiological consequences of this. Explain the nervous system regulation of respiration and how various chemical factors affect this. Air pressure. The air pressure at sea level is about 1 atmosphere or 1,000 millibars and varies depending on altitude, temperature and other environmental conditions. This pressure corresponds to about 760 millimetres of mercury. But what is pressure? Imagine a tight container into which you put pure oxygen gas. All molecules are in motion, except at a temperature of absolute zero, at minus 273 degrees Celsius. Oxygen molecules are bouncing around inside the container, colliding with each other and the container walls. It is these collisions against the wall of the container that creates pressure. If you reduce the container volume, for example, by pushing down using a piston, the gas molecules are in a smaller space, so will now collide more frequently with the wall, therefore the pressure inside increases. Reducing the volume for a given amount of gas molecules creates a higher pressure. Conversely, a larger volume, which allows greater distance between gas molecules, results in a lower pressure. The relationship between pressure and volume of a gas means that if you have half the volume of the container, you double the pressure. If you double the volume of the container, the pressure will be halved, as long as the temperature remains constant. This is Boyle's law. As stated earlier, the air pressure around you is at 760 millimetres of mercury. If you were in the Himalaya, atmospheric pressure decreases as you climb up a mountain. The higher you are above sea level, the less gravity pulls the gas molecules and the greater the distance is between the molecules. Therefore, the pressure is lower. Exercise in altitude. In the above description, together with the physiological knowledge of hematology, we can explain why some top athletes travel to altitude before a competition. What these athletes do is train the body at high altitude where there is lower oxygen gas pressure than at sea level or the lowlands where most people live. Receptors in the body will detect that the oxygen supply to the body is lower than demand and will compensate for this. It does this by producing more red blood cells, whose role is to transport oxygen in the body. The higher the number of red blood cells, the more oxygen gas can be transported. After some weeks at altitude, the athletes travel back to lower altitudes to compete. Their body is adapted to transport oxygen gas at low air pressures at altitude. At low altitude, the athletes therefore have a surplus of red blood cells, meaning that they have more red blood cells than can bind and transport oxygen, enabling their muscles to do more work before fatigue sets in with the production of lactic acid. Lactic acid is produced when tissues metabolise anaerobically, that is, without using oxygen. The partial pressure. Normal air is composed of about 21% oxygen, 78% nitrogen, and 0.04% carbon dioxide gas, and smaller percentages of other gases and water vapour. This means that the oxygen gas constitutes 21% of the air pressure. The partial pressure of oxygen, i.e. the pressure oxygen creates alone, is 21% of 760 millimetres of mercury, i.e. 159 millimetres of mercury. Similarly, the partial pressure of nitrogen is 597 millimetres of mercury, and the partial pressure of carbon dioxide gas is 0.3 millimetres of mercury. Respiratory volume. Breathing is an active process using energy during inspiration when the diaphragm and intercostal muscles contract. The diaphragm pulls down towards the abdomen and the intercostal muscles cause the chest to move outwards, therefore expanding the thorax. This increased volume in the thorax results in negative pressure in the lungs, and this is required to draw air into the lungs. Breathing out, however, is a passive process. Energy is not required because as the muscles relax back to their resting length, the lungs recoil due to their elasticity. In addition, both the surface tension inside and the elastic fibres outside of the alveoli also participate in lung tissue contraction. Overall, this creates the positive pressure when the lung is compressed and the air in the lungs is forced out. During each breath, 500 mL or half a litre of air is inhaled and the same volume is exhaled. This volume is called the tidal volume. However, this volume of air is not completely replaced for every breath. Rather, a proportion of air is replaced. This is explained later. During a forced expiration, it is possible to expire approximately 1,500 mL of air. This is called the expiratory reserve volume. Even then, there is still about 1,000 mL of air left in the lungs. The air remaining in the lungs is called the residual volume. After inspiring normally, with effort it is possible to inspire another 3,000 mL of air, the inspiratory reserve volume. The tidal volume, inspiratory reserve volume and expiratory reserve volume is called the total vital capacity and indicates the total volume of air available in the lungs. The sum of all the different volumes, i.e. tidal volume, inspiratory reserve volume, expiratory reserve volume, and residual volume of the lungs, corresponds to the total lung capacity. Using a vitalograph or spirometer, it is possible to carry out respiratory tests on lung function. The forced vital capacity, or FVC, is the volume of air that can be expired during a forced expiration. The forced expiratory volume expired in 1 minute, or FEV1, is another indicator of lung dysfunction. Normally, you are able to blow out 80% of this volume in 1 second. Dead space. Of the 500 ml of air inhaled in normal inspiration, not all reaches the respiratory membranes in the lungs in the alveoli. A proportion of the air inhaled and exhaled is standing in the oral cavity, pharynx, larynx and trachea and upper bronchi and bronchioles. This area where the air does not participate in gas exchange is called the dead space, and it represents a volume of about 150 mL. This means that air, which is available for gas exchange, out of the 500 mL inspired, is equivalent to about 350 mL, the inspiratory volume minus the dead space volume. Gas transport. Based on the fact that the air in the lungs is only refreshed for each breath, and that the oxygen and carbon dioxide are diffusing from the alveoli and blood respectively, the gas composition in the alveoli is not identical to the air surrounding us. In the air, the partial pressure of oxygen is approximately 159 millimetres of mercury, and the partial pressure of carbon dioxide is 0.3 millimetres of mercury. In the alveoli, the partial pressure of oxygen is approximately 104 millimetres of mercury, and the partial pressure of carbon dioxide is approximately 40 millimetres of mercury. Blood arriving at the alveoli has a partial pressure of oxygen of about 40 millimetres of mercury. This means there is a much higher oxygen pressure in the alveoli than in the blood. Therefore, oxygen diffuses from the alveoli into the blood down the pressure gradient from high to low concentration until the pressures are equal to 104 millimetres of mercury. The diffusion takes about 0.25 seconds. This corresponds to approximately one-third of the time the blood is in the capillaries in normal resting conditions. This therefore means that the blood velocity can increase 3 times, and the blood will still be in the capillaries for long enough for the maximum amount of oxygen to diffuse across from the lungs. In the body's various tissues, partial pressure of oxygen will be approximately 40 millimetres of mercury due to the continuous consumption in the mitochondria. In other words, the oxygen diffuses from the blood. Here, the partial pressure of oxygen is 104 millimetres of mercury into the tissues, whereas when the blood leaving the tissues has reduced partial pressure of oxygen back to about 40 millimetres of mercury. The partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the alveoli is about 40 millimetres of mercury. In venous blood, partial pressure of carbon dioxide is about 45 millimetres of mercury. This means that carbon dioxide diffuses from the blood into the alveoli and that the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the blood leaving the lungs is 40 millimetres of mercury. In the various tissues, carbon dioxide is produced as a byproduct of metabolism and energy production. Therefore, the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the tissues is 45 millimetres of mercury. Thus, carbon dioxide diffuses into the blood from the tissues down the pressure gradient, where the partial pressure of carbon dioxide is lower, about 40 millimetres of mercury. Oxygen transport. Oxygen is transported by the blood in mainly two ways. Dissolved in plasma, bound to hemoglobin. Only about 1.5% of oxygen is transported dissolved in plasma. Much more oxygen is carried bound to hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a large protein molecule located inside the red blood cells, the erythrocytes. Hemoglobin contains a heme group, which contains iron. These heme groups contain iron, and these are the oxygen binding structures. One hemoglobin molecule contains four heme groups and can thus bind four oxygen molecules. And in each red blood cell, there are approximately 250 million hemoglobin molecules. This means that a red blood cell can carry 1 billion oxygen molecules. In a microliter of blood, there are about 5 million red blood cells. Given the body contains 4 to 6 litres of blood, a lot of oxygen can be transported. Carbon dioxide transport. Carbon dioxide is transported by the blood in three ways. Dissolved in plasma, bound to hemoglobin, in the form of bicarbonate. 7 to 10% of carbon dioxide is transported dissolved in the plasma. 20% of the carbon dioxide is transported bound to hemoglobin and the remainder as bicarbonate. Bicarbonate. Nearly 70% of carbon dioxide is transported in the blood in the form of bicarbonate. Bicarbonate is formed when carbon dioxide chemically reacts with water to form carbonic acid. Carbonic acid dissociates into bicarbonate and hydrogen protons. The arrows pointing in both directions indicate that this reaction goes in both directions, that is, it is reversible. The reaction taking place in the body tissues where carbon dioxide is produced is shown in the equation from left to right. When the blood arrives at the alveoli, the equation goes the other way and carbon dioxide diffuses out of the blood. When this happens, bicarbonate and hydrogen are combined to produce carbon dioxide and water. Carbon dioxide is expelled from the lungs during expiration. This chemical reaction occurs both in blood plasma and inside the red blood cells. Inside the red blood cells, this reaction occurs 1,000 times faster than in the blood plasma because the red blood cells contain the enzyme carbonic acid anhydrase, which catalyses the production of carbonic acid from carbon dioxide and water, and vice versa. The definition of an acid is a substance that produces hydrogen. As we can see, carbonic acid dissociates into bicarbonate and hydrogen. It is important to note that hydrogen is a part of this reaction, and the figure thus tells us that there is a relationship between carbon dioxide and acid in the blood. If the carbon dioxide level in the blood increases, the amount of carbonic acid also increases, and so does the hydrogen. It is the concentration of free hydrogen, i.e. those not combined with a negatively charged anion, which determines the pH. Thus, the more carbon dioxide, the more acid, the more hydrogen, the lower the pH. A logical consequence of this is that respiration helps regulate blood pH. By blowing out carbon dioxide, the hydrogen is combined. This hydrogen and acid disappears from the blood and the pH increases. This is an example of acid-base regulation. Acid-base regulation is more thoroughly reviewed in the E-Compendium of Renal Physiology. Oxygen-hemoglobin dissociation curve. A hemoglobin molecule is capable in certain conditions of combining with up to four oxygen molecules. When a hemoglobin molecule binds four oxygen molecules, we say that this hemoglobin is saturated with oxygen. So if all the hemoglobin molecules in the red blood cells are combined with the full complement of oxygen molecules, we say that the blood is 100% saturated. When blood is 100% saturated with oxygen, it means that the blood has combined with the full amount of oxygen it is capable of. How high the oxygen saturation is at any time is determined by the partial pressure of oxygen. The P refers to the partial pressure. This is a measure of the pressure exerted by a gas in a liquid. In this case, the pressure exerted by oxygen in blood. The amount of binding of oxygen to hemoglobin is dependent on the partial pressure of oxygen. Figure 14 shows the relationship between partial pressure of oxygen and oxygen saturation. This shows that at a partial pressure of oxygen of 90 millimetres of mercury, the blood is 100% saturated with oxygen. The figure also shows that at a partial pressure of oxygen of 70 millimetres of mercury, saturation is above 95%, and a partial pressure of oxygen of 40 millimetres of mercury is about 75% saturated. Based on what we know of partial pressure of oxygen values in the body, covered in an earlier section, you will see from figure 14 that the blood leaving the alveoli, where the partial pressure of oxygen is 104 millimetres of mercury, is 100% saturated with oxygen. In the tissues where partial pressure of oxygen is about 40 millimetres of mercury, oxygen is released into the tissues, but oxygen saturation of venous blood is still about 75%. Based on this reasoning, it is thus only 25% of the oxygen which is transported into the tissues from the blood. The rest will follow the blood back to the lungs. Oxygen saturation will therefore normally only vary between 100% and 75% in arterial and venous blood respectively in the systemic circulation. This means that we have a fairly large reserve of oxygen in the blood at any time during normal resting conditions. When the partial pressure of oxygen drops below 40 millimetres of mercury, the curve is steep, and a small change in partial pressure of oxygen below 40 millimetres of mercury may have major effects on the saturation. A slight change in partial pressure of oxygen causes a relatively high oxygen diffusion from the blood. An oxygen saturation below 75% is a condition called hypoxia, insufficient oxygen. Hypoxia is a critical condition because the blood cannot release the oxygen to the tissues because there is no longer a different pressure gradient between the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood and the tissues. They are both at 40 millimetres of mercury. In addition, the curve is steep and it therefore only takes a small change in partial pressure of oxygen to cause a large drop in saturation. In the worst case, saturation in the blood may become lower than the normal tissue partial pressure of oxygen. For this reason, oxygen is given to patients with hypoxia well before this happens. Blood saturation of oxygen is affected by blood oxygen and carbon dioxide levels, as well as temperature and pH. Remember that pH and CO2 are closely related, as discussed in an earlier section. Figure 15 shows that both increased carbon dioxide level, i.e. lowered pH, and increased temperature decrease hemoglobin's ability to bind and retain oxygen. The chart shows that the curves are shifted to the right, i.e. oxygen saturation for a given partial pressure of oxygen decreases. This is physiologically an important concept. Increased carbon dioxide level or lowered pH and increased temperature is found mostly in active tissues where energy consumption and energy demand is high. This happens, for example, in skeletal muscles during physical activity. According to figure 15, we see that when such physical changes occur, oxygen saturation decreases. Decreased saturation means that oxygen molecules detach from hemoglobin or bind only weakly to hemoglobin and therefore diffuse more easily. During increased activity, more oxygen is available in the tissues than during lower physical exertion or resting conditions. Regulation of respiration. The Respiration Control Center is located in the medulla oblongata and in some structures of the pons. These nerve centers control the contractions of the diaphragm and the intercostal muscles, therefore regulating respiration. There are three areas in the medulla oblongata and pons that regulate respiration. The ventral respiration group, VRG, located in the medulla oblongata. The dorsal respiration group, DRG, located in the medulla oblongata. The pontine centres, located in the pons. It is the neurons in the VRG that regulate inspiration. Here, neurons send rhythmic nerve impulses that cause contraction of the diaphragm and the intercostal muscles at regular intervals, every time you inhale. DRG regulates VRG. DRG receives impulses from stretch and chemoreceptors in blood vessels, muscles and lung tissue. DRG can then, through regulating VRG, adjust how often and how deeply to breathe. The pontine centres adjust respiration so that it is smooth and not staccato. Chemical and mechanical control mechanisms. The chemical factors that govern respiration rate and depth are oxygen, carbon dioxide and hydrogen, pH. High CO2, low pH, is the strongest stimulus for respiration. In other words, it is not the amount of oxygen in our blood that is most essential for the respiration regulation. The body is more concerned with the amount of carbon dioxide rather than the amount of oxygen in the blood. This can be explained by the fact that the blood is normally 100% saturation with oxygen. Thus, there is a large reserve of oxygen. So whether you breathe more or less, oxygen levels do not change very much, particularly in normal resting conditions. However, the body has a big challenge if carbon dioxide builds up. We recall that carbon dioxide and pH are closely related, and a high level of carbon dioxide will result in a lower pH in the blood. This must be carefully controlled so as not to disrupt the biochemical processes in the body by disrupting the acid-base balance. For these reasons, carbon dioxide and pH are the strongest stimuli for controlling respiration, because it is important to be able to exhale carbon dioxide and keep pH at around 7.4. Receptors in the aortic arch and the arteries leading blood to the brain detect changes in carbon dioxide in the blood. In addition to the chemoreceptors, there are stretch receptors in the lung tissue, muscles and joints that stimulate respiration. For example, during a jog, respiration will increase even before the need for additional oxygen has been detected. This is because the stretch receptors in the muscles and joints are activated immediately during increased activity, and consequently stimulate respiration so that the body is prepared for this activity. There are also receptors in the lung tissue that respond to irritating substances such as mucus, dust, pollen and other particles that may affect respiration. Dust and particles can initiate protective reflexes that contract the bronchioles. In addition, the ventilation of the lungs is reduced. Finally, one should not forget that the cerebral cortex can override the respiration centres to regulate respiration. For a short period, you'll be able to override respiration, i.e. consciously hold your breath or breathe faster without problems. Hyperventilation. In addition to being a factor that regulates respiration, carbon dioxide is also a local factor which regulates vasoconstriction in various tissues. For example, high levels of carbon dioxide in the brain induce vasodilation to increase the blood flow so that the carbon dioxide can be removed. A person with anxiety attacks or who knowingly is hyperventilating is blowing carbon dioxide out of the lungs. Oxygen is not affected as the blood gas is still 100% saturated. When carbon dioxide is blown out of the lungs, carbon dioxide is removed from the blood, because the diffusion from the blood into the alveoli will increase if the level in the alveoli decreases during hyperventilation. When carbon dioxide levels in the blood decrease, pH increases. The consequence of this may be that carbon dioxide, as a stimulus for vasodilation, disappears and the blood vessels vasoconstrict. Thus, the blood flow to the brain decreases. In addition, with decreasing carbon dioxide in the blood, the strongest stimulus to maintain respiration also disappears. Thus, the brain does not detect the need to increase the respiratory rate. This can lead to dizziness and fainting. Therefore, a person who is involuntarily hyperventilating should be encouraged to breathe into a paper bag, because carbon dioxide is then returning to the lungs instead of being blown out. Thus, vasodilation in the brain is sustained, and so is the stimulus for respiration. This therefore reduces the risk of fainting. Summary. Respiration is composed of inspiration, which is an active process, and expiration, which is a passive process. The inspiration is controlled by several centres in the medulla oblongata and pons that initiate contractions of the diaphragm and the intercostal muscles. The result is that the diaphragm is pressed against the abdomen and the chest lifted forward and somewhat extended. This creates a negative pressure within the thorax, which thus draws air into the lungs. Every time you inhale about 500 mL. Of this, approximately 350 mL is participating in gas exchange. The air in the lungs freshen up a little every time you breathe, and the gas mixture in the alveoli is not equal to the air outside of you. Oxygen diffuses from the alveoli into the blood, which becomes 100% saturated, and is transported dissolved in plasma or bound to hemoglobin in the blood. In normal resting conditions, about 25% of the oxygen is delivered in the tissues. In the tissues, carbon dioxide diffuses into the blood and is transported in plasma, bound to hemoglobin or as bicarbonate. When the blood arrives in the lungs, carbon dioxide enters the alveoli by diffusion. Blood arriving at the lungs under normal resting conditions is about 75% saturated with oxygen.